Hi, this is Bob Gruen, rock and roll photographer from New York, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Is there a library, a bookstore around here where I get books on
rock and roll?
Rock and roll.
Story's true.
Have you read this one?
Sir, read my book?
This is a story that needs to be told.
These rock and rollers want something to read.
Welcome to another edition of the Rock and Roll Librarian. Diggers, I give you Shelley Sorensen.
Thank you.
Speech.
No, I couldn't.
Oh, come on. This is an award show. This is our award show, right?
Oh, okay. I'm happy to accept this award.
Yeah, imagine if you were getting the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Award, would you?
On behalf of all librarians around the world that love rock and roll. That's my speech.
Aren't you going to thank anybody?
Thanking Christian Swain, of course.
I didn't mean me. I mean, I don't, you know.
My family.
There you go. I'd start
my,
there.
My family, yeah, my producers,
okay, now,
my writers.
Now that you can thank me as the producer, yes.
Right. My mother,
who
always believed
in me.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. How about anything about the struggle, how difficult it was?
Wasn't really that difficult. No, sorry. Sorry, people. I have not suffered too much adversity in my life as a librarian or a rock and roll fan.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Is librarian known as a dangerous job or something?
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, sure. You got, you know, all kinds of people coming into the library.
Yeah.
Distributing Narcan and, you know, saving
what?
Lives and stuff like that.
Yeah. Really?
Yep.
Oh,
you know, reversing opioid fatalities.
Yeah. Are you telling me that there's like people who like go into the library to, you know, get high and then
The bathrooms, the public restrooms. Right.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But, you know.
All right, we're starting off on a good note today. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's book time, and this is a good one, and it's current, very, very current.
Yes, it was just released a month or two ago. The title of the book is Face It by Debbie Harry of Blondie.
Uh-huh.
And it's a really cool book physically. I'm glad I didn't read it on an electronic book version because it's just chock full of lovely fan art and photography of Debbie. So the fan art are paintings and other, you know, multimedia graphic projects that people have done of Debbie, most common being her face, which is one of the reasons she titled the book Face It.
Well, she's got a pretty nice face.
She does. She has a very beautiful, unusual face. So the other reason she called the book Face It was the amount of times that she's been photographed, because she's a very much, much photographed woman, and also having to face her history again after having lived it. So she
layers
wrote this,
upon layers.
Yep.
I love it.
There's lots of reasons. She wrote this with an author called Sylvia Simmons. And it says it's based on a series of recent exclusive interviews. So I'm not sure how much pen to paper Debbie took or whether this was all based on interviews, but it reads very easily. It's really a nice conversational style, and it's got all these really incredible paintings and drawings throughout it. And and it was just published a month or two ago.
Well, that sounds awesome. So let's get into it. I guess we should probably start with a song to remind everybody of just how awesome and significant that Blondie as an act was. So let's start with something most people are going to know. I think we should go with Dreaming, huh?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good one.
I met you in a restaurant.
Yeah, one of those seminal bands, if I can use that word again, out of the Hilly's little joint down in the Bowery, CBGB's.
Yep.
These guys are one of the first, if I remember right, to really make it. And they're early, like 75, 76.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're fronted with what basically is a supermodel, although I doubt she had the height to actually be one of those, but she definitely had the face.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this whole attitude that just is transcendent and palpable through all of her music. There is not a voice like it. You know, I wouldn't say she's got a great voice, but there's something really interesting about it whenever you hear
it. Attitude.
Yeah, attitude.
Totally, yeah. And I remember, you know, like, you said them becoming big in 75. That was when I graduated from high school and head off to college. And Blondie is a real part of the fabric of the first few years of my life of independence in Berkeley and Oakland in those days. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a soft spot in my heart for Blondie.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think she started off as Blonde, or Debbie.
No.
In any of those, right?
No. In fact, she was adopted at 3 months of age by the family, the Harry family. And her given name was Angela, and they changed her name to Deborah when they adopted her. She was the love child of a married man and his lover, but then, you know, was a put up for adoption, adopted by this suburban middle-class family in New Jersey. And, you know, one of the things that she says in the book is that she had a big personality on the inside, but not the outside when she was a child. So she had all these kind of fantasies and love of fashion and fantasies about being a star and that kind of thing. But she grew up in this very, you know, conservative suburban home and dressed very conservatively until she got to high school. And then she started, you know, sewing her own clothes and going to thrift stores and really wanting to stand out and be kind of artistic and bohemian. That was her vision for herself. And she found out she was adopted at about age 4 and credits that with having anxieties about being separated and abandoned that kind of stayed with her throughout her life.
Yeah.
Which a lot of adoptive people
experience,
because that's a big loss to think that you were separated from your birth family and then you don't fit
in
where you are.
All the questions that come along with that. There's no two ways that you wouldn't feel abandonment issues, regardless of how much love and affection you're getting from, your adoptive parents. There's always that question in the back of your mind. Something that I didn't know, you just don't even think about this, is that, you know, she was born in 45. You know, you think of her as an 80s, you know, superstar, but she's kind of like fits in the age bracket of more like the 60s bands and things like that.
And it's interesting because a lot of the first songs that Blondie did were based on girl group, kind of 60s girl group. And she would really loved, you know, the Shangri-Las and that whole kind of 60s dance music thing.
You can
hear they incorporated a lot of that into their songs, but made it, you know, a little subversive, like with the lyrics and everything.
Yeah. You can hear that influence definitely in there.
So she started dyeing her hair blonde. She's a natural brunette at age 14 because she identified strongly with Marilyn Monroe. Her vulnerability and femaleness, and she wanted to be platinum blonde. And she, you know, did all the things a lot of teenage girls do, experimenting with makeup, boyfriends, and sex, which she liked more than she was supposed to, as she says. Some of us did, yes.
Yeah, we all find out that we're lied to quite a bit when we're children, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that. You'll go blind.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, after, you know, she was of more of a teenage age, like 16, 17, she started taking the bus to New York City and loved Greenwich Village.
Yeah, because she grew up in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, she was a suburban girl.
So close by.
Right. So she graduated from high school in 63 and then went to community college for an AA in arts and then found a job in New York City and moved there for a while to the Lower East Side and met all of those fascinating people that were doing avant-garde and kind of experimental stuff in New York City at the time. She wanted to be a painter, but she got drawn more and more into music and realized that she wanted to be a performer. And everywhere that she went in New York City, of course, there was really interesting musical kinds of stuff going on. For example, she walked into this club called the Balloon Farm, and there was the Velvet Underground playing. And Andy Warhol was designing the sets and the lighting for Velvet Underground. And she was really attracted to that, you know, that type of person and that group of people to hang out with. She saw Janis Joplin perform. And she got a job at the first head shop in New York City called The Head Shop, The Head Shop, which was a good place to meet people who wanted to break the rules, which is what she wanted to do.
Well, that sounds like a good name for the first head shop.
Yeah,
in,
The
New
Head
York
Shop. Very straightforward.
Yeah. No questions here. You know exactly what you're getting into.
And then anyway, so for her musical career, finally, she met up with an old high school friend and her husband to sing backups and duets in a band called Wind in the Willows, which was a psychedelic folk band.
Oh, so this was her first
that
real band.
That was her first band okay. that she was in. Uh-huh. And the producer of the album...
What year is this? Do you know?
68.
Oh, see again, it's just fascinating that you just don't think of her as being so much in that 60s milieu. But once you realize it, you're like, oh, wow. Okay, that makes a lot of sense with what comes later.
Right. And, you know, everybody, a lot of people in that day, like Chrissy Hynde, she struggled for years, you know, playing music with people and then going to London and, you know, soaking stuff up and just playing around and finally finding the people that she wanted to make the Pretenders with. So yeah. I think that's kind of what happened with Debbie. So anyway, I thought it would be fun to listen to a song from the Wind in the Willows band called Wheel of Changes, which is a duet with the male singer in the band. Whose
okay.
name I can't remember.
All right. Let's get to it, though. What is it called again?
Wheel of Changes.
I've never heard this. Wheel of Changes.
One and one, two, three, or four, and ABC come looking for a place someone thinks you ought to live in. For sandbox walls that fade into darkened halls, women with no face at all.
Disappointed, tell you how to come on smiling.
Ah. Happily and joyfully, you walk on past the quadrilla of patterns that no one has said should matter.
Are we sure that wasn't a skit on Saturday Night Live?
I know. It sounds like it's like a parody of what it's supposed to be.
They're like a bad version of the Mamas and the Papas.
Well, you'll be happy to know that she left them shortly thereafter.
Good choice.
Yeah. One of the reasons because they didn't perform very much and she had no influence, which is good to know that if she'd had influence, it wouldn't have sounded like that.
One could hope. I mean, there's no guarantee, but
yeah.
I guess any improvement would be better than
sure.
That.
It's good experience for her though.
Yeah. Of course.
And she wanted to do something more rock and roll. She really wanted, you know, the rock and roll in her life. And this wasn't really rock and roll.
Yeah. But this is 1968, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I get it. It's that moment. It's a little on the back end of the folk
Summer
revival
of love, sure.
Scene and people had already started to move on and the sound had already started to get tougher by the later 60s, certainly
right.
68 and 69. So they wouldn't have been in the musical zeitgeist, if you will. So good for her.
Yeah.
But again, it shows just, gosh, how far back, you know, her performing career begins before she becomes, you know, this giant international superstar.
Right. So she would have been, what, 23 here, I guess.
Yeah.
So she's making her way, you know, mm-hmm. in the world and meeting people. That's the most important thing to do. So in that vein,
I'm sure that was not hard for her to do.
No.
Not with a face like that.
And being so artistic and interested in working on, you know, new projects and stuff.
Yeah.
She got a job as a waitress at Max's Kansas City in New York City. And that was
good choice.
Totally the place to be seen.
Oh, yeah.
There were, like, Andy Warhol took over the back room with his people, Hollywood stars and rock stars, and people like Steve Winwood, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, who was a big tipper, by the way, which is nice to know, and Miles Davis
She got to serve Janis, huh?
Yeah. Tipped big. She loved Janis Joplin.
Oh.
The place to be seen. They had a lot of characters hanging out there.
Velvet Underground.
She said everyone on the scene did drugs. That was part of the creative process and the social life and was seen as chic and fun. It wasn't scary yet. People weren't falling to the left and right from doing drugs. They were still using drugs to kind of stimulate their creative.
Expand your mind.
Yep. And she even had left Max's, well, first of all, to move to California very shortly with some rich boyfriend, but then she didn't like it there. So she moved back and she became a Playboy bunny for a few months.
Not surprising. Yeah. I think I've seen pictures of her in the Playboy bunny outfit.
Though, you know, she said it's kind of like recruiting for the army. You know, you think it looks like fun. And then she got all the training and she got there and realized, oh my God, this is really just hard work. It's harder than working at Max's and it's not as much fun.
Yeah.
So she didn't do that for very long.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a stepping stone.
But she did it. She can add that to her resume, which, you know, at one time was quite chic and exotic to be a known Playboy bunny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although she was never in the magazine or any of that.
I don't think so. No, she wasn't.
Just the club.
A centerfold or anything. Yeah, she was just basically a waitress.
Yes, a glorified waitress with some bunny ears. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. One of the bands that she became good friends with during that time was the New York Dolls in the early 70s.
David Johansen, you know, Sylvain, Johnny Thunders. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they became like really close. And when they wanted to go meet the head of Paramount A&R, who was Marty Thaw, do you say Thaw or Thau? Thau. She borrowed her dad's huge turquoise Buick to drive the Dolls and all their girlfriends to meet this guy. And the car broke down on the way and the suburban police came by and were met with this car crammed full of very eccentric looking people with, you know, teased hair and makeup and
the glam look of the New York Dolls. Right.
And so somehow she got them to the meeting. And shortly after that, this A&R guy, Marty, quit to be the Dolls manager, and so they got their start at that time in the bigger world. She wanted to be like them, but there just weren't women leading rock bands back then. But that's really what she wanted to do.
None at all.
Yeah.
You could be a female fronted artist of some form, kind of a la Janis Joplin or Aretha Franklin, but it wasn't a rock band.
Right.
I guess Janis came the closest to, you know, just fronting a rock band, certainly
right.
a Big Brother.
But did she consider herself the leader of the band?
No, definitely not. Right. Although, you know, she was the one that got plucked out and turned into a superstar. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. One kind of misstep Debbie made along the way here was that she got into a relationship with a man who was a house painter in New Jersey. So she went back to live with him in New Jersey, but was still going into the city for, you know, her social life. And it turned out he didn't like that too much. The first warning signs were that he was very controlling. He didn't want her to have her own life. And when she went her own way, he got very possessive. And so she broke up with him. But after that, the problem wasn't over because he started stalking her.
Oh.
And at one point, he broke into her house while she was there alone and scared the shit out of her. And, you know, eventually she had to move to get away from him. So she moved back to New York City and started her own life there and finally kind of shook him loose. Later on, she wrote a song about this, which we will visit, you know, during the next part of our podcast.
Oh, a little secret to be revealed at a later time.
Yep, that's
awesome.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So get us out of the Wind in the Willows.
Yes.
Well, that's 68. I'm sure we're starting to get into the mid 70s here. If she's
right.
The beginning 70s.
She actually got together with two other ladies, Elda Gentile and Amanda Jones, to perform a girl group called the Stilettos, which is a good name for
Now that one I'd heard about, the Stilettos. So
they did rock and roll, R&B, and show tunes, and just kind of experimenting with different things that three women could do with their voices. And they had their first gig.
Yeah, like the girl group. So she's always had this fascination with the girl groups.
Yeah, She loved all those girl groups. Yeah, she was definitely a girl 60s music kind of
aficionado.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So they went out to do their first gig and was just like friends and stuff. But for some reason, she got really scared. She got cold feet. So she decided to focus on this silhouette in the darkness and sang her songs to that person, not knowing who it was. And guess who it turned out to be? Somebody very important that she didn't know and that she felt like she had a psychic connection to.
Chris Stein.
Yes, Chris Stein. She was drawn to him as if by a magnet. I wonder if Chris Stein could be considered Debbie Harry's muse.
Maybe
he could be covered on Muses.
That's something to bring up with Shante and Lynx.
So he started playing bass.
Muses don't have to be female.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I know.
So
Stilettos.
And so we have a song from the Stilettos. And, you know, Chris Stein, of course, turned out to be her friend, collaborator, and lover for 13 years, and then collaborator for more than that. And the only song I could find of theirs on YouTube is called Anti-Disco, and she actually sings backup. There's lots of harmonies in this band, which was something she really enjoyed.
Yeah, isn't Chris in the band? Isn't he?
He started playing bass with them.
Okay. So, all right, so we're going to play Anti-Disco by the Stilettos. Well, not much of an improvement over the folk band,
different direction. But
early punk, but a real attempt at trying to convey, you know, the nihilism of punk there. I'm glad she moved on.
She did eventually. But first they had this, you know, they really did it up. They had an actual musical theatrical director to help them with their stage presence and their costumes. They, you know, were really into kind of getting things from thrift stores and working them up into some stylish thing. And this guy named Tony Ingracia was their image coordinator, choreographer, and he was also well-connected, which wasn't a bad thing. He had worked with Andy Warhol. He worked on the musical Fame on Broadway, and he worked with Bowie's management company. So he pushed them to deliver the feelings. He was into method acting, and she thought that was really the best thing for her at that point, you know, that she had been working on the technical capabilities of singing, but this was really helpful for her to, you know, really be trained in this way in expressing feelings and, you know, getting the picture across of what you are trying to portray.
And, creating a full character to present on stage.
Right.
And through method acting, this becomes something that I guess you can turn on and turn off at will.
Right.
Okay. I see where we're going.
And I think this
okay.
kind of plays into her later, you know, creation of the Blondie character. Mm-hmm. But one of the first good things they got out of it was because this guy had a connection with David Bowie. David Bowie yeah. came to actually see them play and brought his wife, his then wife, Angie.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And she said they had the coolest, most fucked up crowds in their audience, which was cute. But this is the pivotal point at which they actually form Blondie, because she and Chris left the band, the Stilettos, and formed their partnership, which they have till this day, this musical partnership.
Yeah. There's been breaks, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We just saw him a couple of months ago, and you know, Chris was there right along with her.
Yeah. She claims they have a psychic partnership, too. She's definitely down with the psychic stuff. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to do what the Dolls were doing, but she couldn't have done any of that without Chris. So they were really definitely a working partnership. They added some Fred Smith on bass and Billy O'Connor on drums. And the first band name they had for this band was Angel and the Snake. Yeah. So,
okay.
And in this iteration, they opened for the Ramones at CBGB. And then they became Blondie and the Bonzai Babies.
Getting there. Okay.
Yeah. And they named her Blondie after the cartoon character, you know, right. in the Bumsteads. And they had backup singers, you know, female backup singers. And
so Debbie was out front.
She was out front.
But then they weren't the Stilettos, were they?
No, they were Blondie and the Bonzai Babies.
Oh.
And eventually they became just Blondie. But in this early stage, they did a lot of girl group songs. They covered Beach Boys. They sang Lady Marmalade. And she wanted to bring the dancing back to rock and make this a crossover between glam rock and punk.
Okay.
That was their vision.
Not bad. Not a bad way to go, especially 74, 75.
Yeah.
You know, glam is kind of, it's at its peak and we're beginning to wane here by that. And then this new sort of aggressive sound is out in the streets of New York City there, you know, hence, you know, what we now call punk, right?
Right. Yeah. And they were right in the middle of it. At this time, she and Chris wrote the song Rip Her to Shreds, and they kept playing and experimenting and eventually just became Blondie. So let's have a listen to Rip Her to Shreds, one of the first songs they wrote together.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah, I remember hearing that song and just thinking, ooh, it was so catty, but it was really fun.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to be that catty, just like really on, you know, out there with it and not hiding it.
It's just like it's fully formed here. This is Blondie. There's no two ways about it. And you know, the songs that we've played up till now, they are train wrecks. This is cool.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, that combination of kind of the soft girl group thing with them coming in with their you know, the male voice is coming in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really, really a cool
You
record.
Know, it's funny. You know, we saw Blondie here a couple of months ago and she opened for Elvis Costello. And I can hear a little of that Elvis Costello and the attractions,
uh-huh.
you know, the
sneering,
the Steve Naive sort of keyboard in the background. And yeah. yes, the Elvis sneering, you know, which was, again, it's
part of the
punk one of the
punk sensibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Tom Petty had some sneering for sure. Sure, too.
Yeah. In that southern drawl kind of way, but yeah.
So she goes on to, you know, say that, okay, this was the beginning of the first 7 years of the Blondie insanity. And it's hard to remember the fun and funny times when, you know, looking back on it, because as we will see, it took a big toll on her life, the first 7 years of Blondie. First, they let Billy, the drummer, go, and because maybe you don't really know that name, because shortly thereafter,
Clem Burke.
And on the first album, we have Clem Burke. Now, they had open auditions for the new drummer, and they had 50 responses. Their ad that went out was Freak Energy Rock Drummer Wanted. So he was the very last one they heard. And he was the one that they knew was the right one. And then their bass player left to join the band Television. That was Fred Smith.
Yeah.
So they almost broke up at that time because they were so shocked that Fred left. But Clem, who had just come on, was so enthusiastic about playing with them that he kind of shored them up and kept them going until they could hire somebody else, who was Gary Valentine.
Yeah.
Now, he looked like he should be in a rock band, which is one of the reasons they hired him. He was a guitar player, but he replaced Fred on bass for a while in the early part of the time.
Well, I can see why Fred would leave Blondie for Television. With hindsight, of course, that seems ridiculous. But Television is really ahead of the curve right at that moment. And they look like they're about ready to break out and hit it big, of which they didn't. But they're very influential.
Yeah.
You know, they're one of the first to really get out of CBGBs and become, you know, something for a short period of time.
Yeah, I gotta go back and delve into them some more because I've been reading a lot about them.
Yeah, their name keeps coming up.
Yeah,
right?
it does over and over.
Yeah.
Speaking of CBGBs, that it was still a dive bar at that time, and they, Blondie.
I think it was a dive bar the whole time.
Yeah, right. They played there every weekend for 7 months straight, and they were paid in beer, not money. And the crowd was, you know, just a combination of their friends, other bands, and all the downtown artists and freaks.
Yeah.
So it was really a fun time. She talks about how she created this character of Blondie, and she considers the character as the lead singer of Blondie.
Oh, back to this method
as a character.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was partly a visual homage to Marilyn Monroe's character, and partly a statement about the double standard. She felt that Marilyn Monroe was playing a character, the proverbial dumb blonde, and there were smarts behind her act, but her acting wasn't given credit. And now Debbie feels that her Blondie character was actually sort of androgynous. And I know that sounds kind of surprising to people because we think of her as the, you know, prototypical female femme fatale. Mm-hmm. But she actually says these words. She felt like she was playing a transsexual creature. She was a woman playing a man's idea of a woman. But she was an artistic, ass-kicking, assertive woman in girl drag. It's kind of interesting to think about, like in this day of binary, you know, like we really talk a lot about how people,
sexual fluidity.
Yeah, it's on a continuum, you know, the gender kind of expressions. But she was aware of that even back then, you know, because obviously a lot of the people that she hung out with were men in drag and people expressing themselves in all ways. It was a very, you know, accepting time period.
Well, I don't know, accepting time period,
well,
but it was definitely
amongst this crowd.
Yeah. If you were in the club, you were exposed to people living a more free existence of who they felt they were.
Right.
Nowadays, you know, we as a society are beginning to embrace, but certainly was not the case back
then. No, not in the larger society, sure.
But she would learn from that. I can see that. Yeah, it's difficult for me to think of anything other than, you know, this incredibly striking woman with all this attitude. It's not surprising to hear that it's a bit of an act, you know, that's common in any artistic endeavor, is to build this persona. It's almost like a shield in some ways, and it is an accepted character to the audience. It's easily digestible to them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of great artists have done this, especially performing artists, and especially in rock and roll, because this is a 24/7 character that you have to
maintain.
and it can be quite destructive and confusing. There's been plenty of bios of where, you know, the character, you know, overtakes the person.
Right.
Most famously, Alice Cooper, you know, has commented on this numerous times. But, you know, I think this happens to just about everybody. I mean, if anybody's seen the recent Elton John biopic, Rocket Man, you know, it's a big theme about that, is to create this character that's bigger and larger than life than you are, that at once you can hide behind, but you know, at the same time takes over your actual existence, and then it creates conflict, and a lot of horrible things end up happening before you kind of figure out a way to live with that other person who you've created inside yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It doesn't seem like that's what happened to Debbie.
No, it sounds like she was able to actually straddle that better than most.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but at the time when she was doing that, I mean, I was, you know, 20 or something, 19. It didn't really occur to me that she was playing a character. You know, I thought that was her. So I'm not sure what point she was getting across if people didn't understand that's what she was doing.
I think, you know, in the book, you know, she's able to reflect over a lifetime here.
Right.
That I'm betting a good bit of this was subconscious at the time.
Right.
You know, and now, you know, with hindsight, she's been able to say, ah, you know, I did this and I did that to make a statement, utilize some inspirations that I had, like the method acting thing, and present something that would commercially be viable. And I mean commercially in a good way, not, you know, a selling out way, but just, you know, a package that
people would respond to.
Exactly. That's my point. Yes.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, she also, besides that creation of this character, she looks back and she always considers herself that she was a punk. I mean, that this was part of all the confluence of things that came into creating New York punk, that she was part of that. And she
was.
And
yeah.
She, yeah, that sensibility was something that really took hold of her, you know, breaking down walls and boundaries and you know, being artistic and creating something new that was not just rehashing stuff, but creating something new out of the influences that she had, which was part of what the beginning of punk, at least, you know, before you had to dress a certain way or sound a certain way to be punk. It was the idea was all about just stirring things up and creating something new. Mm-hmm. There weren't, you know, norms about it.
Well, I like the idea of, you know, taking the Marilyn Monroe image and throwing it on its head and giving her, you know, the ultimate agency, which Marilyn did not have.
Right,
And being in your face and just the sexy girl who knows that she is all and a bag of chips.
Right. Well, thank goodness Debbie, you know, exerted more control over her life than poor Marilyn did.
Well, I think she also had a great partner in Chris Stein, who,
right,
you know, really recognized that she wasn't equal,
right,
and utilized that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember her saying at one point that when they were really famous, it was really annoying for people when they got interviewed together, you know, that a lot of the questions would be around
to him, probably
Chris.
Yeah.
How does it feel being, you know, the boyfriend of this sex symbol that every man in America wants? And it's like, what? That's not why he's with her.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, obviously he's attracted to her, but that, yeah, you're right. I mean, she did have a partner that really saw her. The first song that they recorded as a demo was the Shangri-La's or not the first one, but one thing they recorded as a demo, let's just say, was the Shangri-Las Out in the Street, which is telling because this is, you know, her girl group Fascination. They all loved the Shangri-Las, and it became a famous song for them, and I think that they do it really well, but with just a little twist of, you know, irony that you would need in a punk song.
Mm-hmm.
So can we play that, please?
No.
Out in
yes,
the Streets?
Yes, of course we can play this. Okay,
that.
So Out yeah. in the Streets, but there's this Blondie's version of
yeah.
Out in the Streets.
Ooh, he don't hang around with the gang no more. He don't do the wild things that he did before.
Well, there's definitely that girl group influence, which we'll hear throughout the career of the band. And there's Debbie doing all the voices. She doesn't need background singers anymore. So she's doing them all herself. It's a nice, interesting, I wouldn't call it punk. I think now we're getting to the beginnings of what's called new wave, right?
Yeah, but I think the punk part of this song is her kind of deadpan delivery, which is really, I think, different from the original.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how she's just kind of, and then in the middle of the song, you know, she breaks out and starts belting it more, but it's just very spare and kind of deadpan, but then it builds into this more luscious thing.
Yeah.
So they did add a band member at this point. Jimmy Destri is keyboard player. I believe he's still
with them.
I
don't think Jimmy's with
know.
Them.
No, I guess not. Okay, so he was it was with them for quite a while, Jimmy
right.
Destri on keyboards. So, you know, all this time they're struggling and they're recording things, but they, you know, found that other bands around them were getting record deals and they weren't. And, you know, this is the tenacious part of really being an artist and a creator and not giving up and saying, okay, never mind, we're going to, you know, get jobs in the factory or go home and marry the boy next door and have babies or something. They just kept going. And
that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
No plan B.
And finally, you know, they built a following. They played around a lot. They built a following. And finally, they got a record deal with a company called Instant Records. And their first song that they recorded for Instant Records gave them enough buzz for them to get an album deal with that company. So the first one they recorded was, they first entitled Sex Offender, but they had to change it to X Offender because apparently you can't have the word sex as the title of a song.
Not
really,
then.
Really dumb.
Yeah.
Anyway, because it's in the song, but it can't be the title of the song. And it was partly about this ridiculous statutory rape allegation against Gary Valentine, who was their band member, and he was only 18, but before he turned 18, he was having he had a girlfriend who was 16 or 17, and the parents didn't like him, and they waited till he was 18 to accuse him of statutory rape. And so he was on trial, he had to go into hiding and all this stuff. So that was part of the reason for them writing this song. And also is a little bit about the criminalization of hookers, which she found part of the double standard of men and women. And it's about a cop and a hooker who fall for each other and written very quickly. So, yeah. So
well, let's get
listen
to it.
X-Offender.
X-Offender.
Which was on their first album, Blondie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first one that really sounds a lot like Blondie.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's like
fully,
their
yeah.
sound.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And this was the beginning, of course, of their success after they issued the album Blondie, came out in 1977. She describes their success like being strapped to a rocket and ready to be launched. It was riotous, breathless, restless, and crazy. And they went on the road in February 1977 and stayed on the road for quite a while. They went to Los Angeles and had a residency at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And because the Whiskey at that time was looking for something new and fresh. And they signed a 5-year management contract with someone named Peter Leeds, which was a big mistake because they were stuck with him for a long time. Mm. But this was the beginning of, you know, they were played on the radio and there was a Blondie fan club. Tom Petty opened for them the first week that they were at the Whiskey. And the second week they played with the Ramones. So it was all this confluence of L.A., you know, the Whiskey being kind of revived and a center for all this fun stuff and all the people that were there to be seen. And
yeah, the early LA punk scene's beginning to develop as well, you know, where we're going to get X and the Blasters and the Go-Go's and bands like that. So,
which we've covered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Under the Big Black Sun.
That's
right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's a sequel to, which I haven't read, but everybody should read it.
You know, we're going to have a new podcast that is hosted by one of those folks who were a big part of that scene.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Should I guess now or later?
Later.
Okay. All right. So after that, they were tapped by Iggy Pop. He was going on his first tour, or they were going on their first real tour, but it was opening for Iggy Pop, who had David Bowie on the bill with him. Which
oh,
was
this
David.
Is when David was playing keyboards with.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that tour is it doesn't really work very well because nobody wants to pay attention to Iggy. They're all like, oh, my God, David Bowie was right there.
Right.
So, yeah.
Of course, it was thrilling, though, for Blondie to
be
chosen to go on the tour. They were starstruck. They were having so much fun. They played, you know, 20 shows, and they got a lot of advice from Iggy and David on using the big stage and how to, you know, work a crowd, and watching them work was really helpful in the development of Blondie. And she had her first experience of being the only woman on the road with all guys, even though she was in a relationship with Chris. One night, Debbie took David and Iggy up to her room because she wasn't really that into cocaine, but she had some, so she wanted to share it with them.
I know this story.
Yeah, and apparently Bowie took out his cock to
afterwards.
Show her. And she said he did that with men and women alike. That was one of his little cute things he liked to
do. Well, he was giving her props for supplying some good drugs.
Okay.
So, my understanding is that she wasn't bothered by it was rather impressed.
She thought it was funny, adorable, and sexy. She makes a joke about how they must have thought she was the cock check girl.
Uh-huh.
Instead of the coat check girl.
Yeah.
And they all had fun. But then they came home and then they went out on their own tour to England. And it wasn't as much fun as going out with David and Iggy. And they were introduced to UK punk and the fun pogo that the UK punks were doing at the time.
Oh, the pogo. Yes, the pogo dance. Right.
So, yeah, so they came home to 2 great reviews and new fans and went to work on Plastic Letters, which was their second album, 1978. But unfortunately, by this time, they spent some time and money changing labels to Chrysalis Records, and they got $1 million in debt.
Ouch.
Wow. That's called
funny
not
how that
very
happens,
good
huh?
management. I know.
Yeah. The record business, yeah.
And then they added their new bass player, Nigel Harrison, who comes back into the story. Mm. And but, you know, it was a lot of pressure. And as she says, it was especially hard on Chris because they all had pressure, but Chris had the extra pressure of being protective of Debbie and taking care of her. And he wasn't a macho guy. He's a very intelligent, introspective man, and he had this extra added kind of job of being Debbie's kind of bodyguard. Yeah.
That must have been really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
every schmuck who thinks he's got a face is going to hit on her wherever she's available.
Yep. Yeah. Though, I don't know. If I were a man, I don't think I'd go there just because she's, you know, she seems very aloof and kind of unapproachable.
Suit yourself.
Yeah. I'm not a man, so. Anyway, the single off that record was Denise, which was the male version.
Isn't it Denise?
D-E-N-I-S, the French male version of the cover of the song by Randy and the Rainbows from Queens. Their version was called Denise, about a girl, Denise, D-E-N-I-S-E. But this one was Denise. I don't know. Would you pronounce that? She seems to sing Denise. So that seems like the S would be dropped off in French. But anyway.
Denise.
Denise.
Well, we'll just have to take a listen.
Yes.
Let's hear Dennis, Denise, Denise, whatever you prefer.
Denise, 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 Denise. Denis.
Good. Glad you agree.
Denis. Denis.
Yeah, fun yeah. song. Fun song.
Yes.
Like fun. You said, punky, glammy, dancey.
Yep.
Right?
She wanted to get people off their asses and back onto the dance floor.
Right.
Yeah. So they their next album.
Uh-oh.
They're already getting into a next album, like in the same year. They released Parallel Lines, yeah, which of course is the album that everybody knows.
Yeah.
In late 1978.
I know, 1978.
Yep.
Oh, it was only yesterday.
They had a different producer, Mike Chapman, who brought out the best in them. And the record company, though, oddly, didn't think there were any hits on that album.
Really?
Which, really. And as Mike, their producer, said, we're not redoing it. So
get used to it.
Get used to it. And, you know, yeah, ironically, really? some of their best-known songs
Yeah,
are
hanging
on
the telephone, one way or another, picture this, Heart of Glass.
Yeah.
I question this all the time. You know, these guys who think they're so fucking smart.
I know. What do they know?
And get paid all this money to control this and are time and time again shown that they don't know what the fuck they're doing. And that it's something out of left field is actually the thing that
that's right.
That hits.
Yeah. This one was super popular.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's listen to One Way or Another. This was the song I was referring to that was written about her ex-boyfriend, New York stalker.
Oh.
And she takes a really good, you know, like that point of view. She sounds really kind of a little scary on this record.
Like she's going to get him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really like that was what was really interesting about this song, I think, is that a woman was being really
aggressive.
Creepy.
Creepily aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, in some ways is not so bad.
Did you see the movie Fatal Attraction?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little bit much. But yeah, I totally. Yeah. When I listened to the song, it was definitely a stalker, but it was her as the stalker.
Yeah.
But she just transposed it from her personal experience.
Right.
All right. All right. Let's listen.
Like on the other
I love that song. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. One Way or Another.
One way
the quintessential Blondie song. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to pick one, that's got to be it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Were you scared when you listened to it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I totally get the stalker angle. You know, you can look at it as, again, it's a layered song. You can look at it from a couple of different angles, such as a fan who, you know, is going to meet their hero. And then once she achieves the goal, she wants to get away at the end.
Yeah.
Have nothing to do with
the slip.
Yeah, her you know, her intended target.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. I mean, everything comes together, and now this is a hit machine here, right?
Yep. Yeah. And this was definitely one of the ones that you know, like you said, is the quintessential Blondie song. Of course, another one that's on that album, we can't really, you know, there's so many songs on that album that need talking about, but we can't talk about all of them. But the other one was a song, they renamed it Heart of Glass, but they had previously recorded it as a song called Disco Song. And it was supposed to be, you know, a spoof on disco,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The new version was more electro. Everything was built around the synth track. And
well, she did have a song in the previous band called
right.
Disco Sucks, right?
Yeah.
Or not Disco Sucks.
Yeah, but the whole point about, you know, punk was kind of like anti-disco. So this song pissed off the rock and punk critics both. So pissed off people on both sides. But Chris said that it made them punk in the face of punk.
Oh.
So they were punking the disco.
Well, I don't care what you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
But
so.
They even have on the music video, they even have a disco ball on it.
Yeah.
So this one is another quintessential Blondie song. And it's actually the one that they played when they were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes.
2006. All right. So let's hear a little of Heart of Glass. Such a fantastic, dreamy song. I mean, it's a hit spelled all over it. But what you were talking about, these made-up terms, these genres to separate people,
mm-hmm.
divide. You know, one thing that we've determined in our pursuit of this rock and roll archaeology is that, you know, let's just call this the rock and roll age, and, you know, begins in the mid-50s continues even today in some format. But the further we get used to this, you know, these artificial delineators don't really exist. I guess it's a disco song, but it doesn't exactly sound like a disco song. And besides, what is a disco song? It's still got a backbeat to it, and it is very much a product of its times, regardless of who's
right.
playing it.
And the genres bleed into each other, too, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, to get all the grief at the time just seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
A good song is a good song is a good song, and, you know, the first time you hear that, you know, and thankfully the public knew better and said, no, that's a great song. I don't
right.
care what you call it.
I mean, you can play it at a disco for sure.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not a rocker.
A metalhead wouldn't think that anything that Blondie does is quote unquote a rocker.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
you know, again,
that's true.
Yeah. But I'm glad we got to play a little of it.
Yeah. It's a good one. You know, she talks a lot about being photographed so much, not just by her boyfriend, Chris Stein, who most of, you know, many of the excellent photographs of her are by him, and Robert Mapplethorpe, Richard Avedon, Roberta Bailey, yeah. Chalky
Mick
Davis.
Rock, obviously Andy Warhol, famously.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And so this is one of the things she kind of segues into talking about her movie career, you know, that she was a visual person, you know, like what I mentioned at the beginning of the story, which was that she wanted to be a painter.
Yeah.
So all of these areas of artistic endeavor were interesting to her, and that and it's not a surprise that having this look and being interested in performing that she got into movies and television, which she did in between all of these musical projects, starting with the first movie that she was in, which was called Union City, which was an art house movie. And she really enjoyed it so much that she took movie opportunities whenever she could.
Hey, David Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Yeah. And kind of oddly, the record companies didn't want them to branch out into different projects, which she thought was weird because they could have capitalized, you know, said,
again,
oh, and while you're seeing
companies,
this movie,
right.
you know, like they have an out, you know, she is also a singer, so you might want to, you know, listen to her album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good press, bad press. As long as they're talking about you, that's all that matters.
That's right.
Yeah, it could have helped. It definitely helped, especially when you look like Debbie Harry.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
There's a reason why she's one of the most photographed women of the 20th century.
That's right.
And would want to be in movies, or movies would want her to
would
be
want
in
her.
Them,
yeah.
So.
And plus, it turned out she was a good actress, too. So, yeah. So their next album was Eat to the Beat.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the first one, as she said, they made with knowing there was an audience waiting for it, because, you know, they knew now they were big and they could make an album and there would be people waiting for it. She actually says a lot of the songs on the album are pretty minimal. They wrote them very quickly. And one of the ones that they wrote super quickly was one that Jimmy Destri came up with, this spaghetti western type music, and Debbie just played around with the lyrics and wrote them in just a few minutes, and that was the record Atomic.
Oh, okay. Well, let's get a sampling of that and see if we can hear Enrico Morricone in there, huh?
Right.
Said Enrico, it's Ennio Morricone. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know who that is?
He wrote spaghetti westerns.
Well, he wrote the music for them, yeah. Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I can you hear a little of that in there?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, there's something.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think? You disagree?
No, I can definitely hear the spaghetti western in there. Yeah. It's totally spaghetti.
Total spaghetti.
Total spaghetti.
With sauce.
Yeah.
Right? Right. New York sauce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Italian. New York Italian
sauce. Well, speaking of Italian, so the next song that was
big.
Will
you just get a movie off of
that? I know.
I'm tired of this line of questioning.
I'm just looking at my notes and I see the words American gigolo. And I thought, isn't gigolo an Italian word? And see, there I did my stream of consciousness thing.
This is how it works.
Yeah.
Okay.
As the mind of a genius.
All right. Let's go to the gigolo.
So she was asked to sing a song for the movie American Gigolo with Richard Gere.
Oh, that
right?
guy.
Yeah.
Another face.
And the theme song was actually written by Giorgio Moroder.
No, I'm sorry, Giorgio Moroder.
Moroder,
yes, yes, yes.
Who is the hit maker behind Donna Summer.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote the lyrics, but they were way too masculine, from the masculine point of view for Debbie. She didn't think she could sing them.
Mm-hmm.
So she watched the movie, and then she wrote her own lyrics after watching the movie. And the first thing she thought about writing, because she was influenced by the image of the beautiful car driving down the coast highway, and the, you know, because he's like drives fancy cars and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So the first lines that came to her while she was watching the movie were, color me your color, baby, color me your car, which is funny because I just covered this song in a jam session and I went, like, what does that mean? Color me your color, baby, color me your car. But now I understand, because this was about the car driving down the Pacific Coast Highway.
Ooh.
And the refrain had to be call me, because that's what Richard Gere's character says. And she said the rest wrote itself. It was the biggest selling single of their career.
That's right.
Wow.
Well, let's listen to Call Me. Another great Blondie song there.
Yep. Yeah, I'd call her.
Wouldn't have to ask me twice.
Hey.
Down. If I was unmarried.
Yeah.
Me
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Okay.
So, oh, you too. Oh. Didn't know that about you.
No, she's not my type.
No?
No.
Really?
Yep.
I think she's anybody's type.
Oh, I don't know.
No?
It's that sculpted face kind of. You
a
know,
little too
just,
much?
Yeah, just a little like...
Intimidating?
Intimidating. That's it. That's it.
Oh, so...
All right.
But come on. It's like that's the gold standard, right?
I suppose. All right. Their next album was Auto American.
Ooh, it sounds like we hit on some uncomfortable spot here.
No. I appreciate beautiful women for sure.
Yeah.
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 So Auto American was released in 1980.
Yes,
now,
it was.
And this one, they wanted to make music that crossed boundaries, but this was confusing for the record company,
mm-hmm.
because they did, you know, some disco, they did some, like a score to an imaginary film, they did torch songs by Lerner and Lowe, they did the rock steady reggae song Tide Is High, which... we're not going to play right now, but that's a really good song.
No.
So the record company was like, what are you doing here?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they wanted to do. And one of the songs that kind of was part of this diversity theme was Rapture,
mm-hmm.
which she calls a rap song with a downtown rock twist. And she says it was the first rap song with original music. Up until then, rap was done using rhythm tracks and licks from existing songs. So this is her claim. What do you think about that?
I'd have to look to see the veracity of that claim. But I will say it is the first number one rap song. Undisputable.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, rap, of course, comes out of the DJ world. You're spinning two turntables and mostly you're using previously released material,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, finding the great groove,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, rapping over the top of that. So, you know, with Rapture, the song is all original. Yes, I can see that. But I don't know. We'll look into it while we play the song, huh?
Yeah.
Here's Rapture.
Baby,
Yeah, I a little disco rap, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Let me say that a friend of our show, Lanice Bent, who I interviewed, or Deeper Digs in Rock, was the engineer for Auto American.
Oh.
You know, she was instrumental in helping to work on this and many other songs. So, but I want to bring the song back again real quick to get a bit of the actual Debbie rapping here, where she's name checking some famous rappers.
Yeah, I'd like to hear
like
that.
Grandmaster Flash. So, all right, real quick, some of that.
Fab Five Freddy told me everybody's fly. DJ spinning, I said, my, my. Flash is fast, Flash is cool. Francois Safar, Flash ain't no Duke. And you don't stop, shoot a shot. Go out to the parking lot, and you get in your car, and drive real far, and you drive all night, and then you see a light, and it comes right down, and lands on the ground, and out comes a man from Mars. And you try to run, but you got a gun, and he shoots you dead, and he eats your head. And then you're in the man from Mars. You go out at night, you eat Cadillacs, Lincolns too, Mercurys and Subaru, and you don't stop, you keep on eating cars. Then, when there's no more cars, you go out at night and eat up bars, where the people meet face to face.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me about that song is that, in, for example, in the next album that she does, which is her first solo album, she starts, they collaborate, she and Chris, with Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards of Chic.
Yeah.
And so I can see in Rapture what they're doing is kind of copying a black art form, you know, like a genre of rap.
It's got that Nile Rodgers scratch.
Right. But it's like they're imitating it as a band. But in this next project that they work on, what they want to do is take two white musicians and two black musicians and really make something new together instead of like one, you know, they had their niches, their kind of genres. Mm-hmm. And instead of them copying Chic or Chic copying Blondie, they decided to do something more collaborative and bring diversity right into the creative process.
Right.
So, and Chic had already had their commercial hits, Good Times and Le Freak. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for this next album, which was called Cuckoo, which was her solo album.
Right, yeah, her solo album.
Each pair wrote four songs and then they wrote two songs together. And this was before Nile Rodgers worked with David Bowie on
Let's Dance.
Mm-hmm. And Madonna, which I'm not sure what album that was, but they did work with Madonna. So, and she said it was really fun to record. It was, it came out in 81. And she really loves this album, but the record company wasn't happy with her doing a solo project. They only wanted to do Blondie. So I thought we could listen to the song Jump Jump, which is on this album.
Right.
And we've got
Produced by Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we have the added interest of having Mark Mothersbaugh and Gerald Casale of Devo singing backup vocals.
Oh, on this song?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. All right. Let's listen to Jump Jump. Talk about the awesomeness of Bernard Edwards on bass there, huh?
Yeah, I know, that's really cool. That was the first thing that popped out on me.
That guy's a monster. And also the cover of Cuckoo was created by H.R. Giger.
Yep.
Most famously Alien, the image of Alien, and you know, his style was taking human and machine and mixing them together. Other rock and roll artists have used Geiger before in the past. So I do like the concept that Nile is kind of like putting this production feel together that's going to be taken up by David Bowie and turn it into, you know, this giant awesomeness of the album Let's Dance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really neat. I mean, David Bowie keeps coming back into this narrative about Blondie for sure.
Yeah.
After this album, they did another Blondie album called The Hunter, which she doesn't really say much about. She started feeling kind of uncomfortable.
Now we're getting
recording
to the end
with Blondie.
Of Blondie, yeah. as a band. And she's got a solo career. She's doing movies and you know, just the style of music is beginning to change. I can understand why this might not work out for them. And I think some other issues are about to hit us as well.
Yeah, when they went on tour with this album, Chris got really, really sick. Mm-hmm. And he developed a rare autoimmune disorder that really put him out of the ring for like 2 or 3 years. It took him a long time to recover, and he almost died. And Debbie was by his side. You know, he was in the hospital for 3 months. And by the time he was recovered, the band broke up, and their record deal was lost, and they were about to lose their home. I like her quote here. "What else could you be but broke when you sold more than 40 million records?
Oh.
You're at the top of your career, and you've worked nonstop for 7 years with no vacation."
Of course. Broke is the expected.
It's called bad management.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as she says, that anything they could have done business-wise, they did wrong.
Uh-huh.
So that's what happened. It took them a long time to kind of dig themselves out of that.
Yeah. And the record industry, at it again.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So Chris Stein has gotten ill, and the band is kind of fraying. And I think they just kind of call it quits after The Hunter, right? After about 1984.
Yeah, after that they had to call off that tour, you know, most of it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was
and
really
they're,
busy.
And they're gone for like 17, 18
years.
Yeah,
17 years. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Yeah, of course, yeah. I don't remember noticing when they got back together either.
I thought you were going to say, I don't remember the 90s. So.
No,
but
unfortunately,
yeah,
I do.
But she continues doing solo work.
Yeah,
and I think her next album was 1986.
Rockbird.
Rockbird. Right. I want to say something interesting that I bet you don't know, and maybe you do, but I've just discovered this, and I have to bring it up. So the song that we're gonna play is "French Kissing in the USA," right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who wrote that song?
It was a woman who sang the original song and submitted it to get them to try to get a record deal, and her version was beautiful, but she got screwed out of the deal. Who wrote the song?
Chuck Lorre. Do you know who that is?
No.
Oh, he's the guy that produced The Big Bang Theory, 2 and a Half Men.
Oh.
Mike and Molly.
Oh, really? No,
Young Sheldon.
Yeah.
All kinds of American television. Apparently, he composed French Kissing in the USA back in the 80s before all of that.
Did not know that.
Well, we're just going to have to take a listen now.
Yeah. It turned out to be the biggest hit on the album.
Yeah, if you can call that.
Yeah.
It was not a big hit, but the biggest of that. So, all right, here's "French Kissing in the USA." Chuck Lorre went off to produce television. I mean, it's got that big 80s sound. It is stuck in its time, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and it's kind of redundant too, I think. I mean, it sounds like some of the other girl groupie things with the, you know, I mean, not it's pleasant.
Yeah, oh, it's pleasant sure, enough. But it's not, you know, it's not Call Me. It's
right.
not Heart of Glass.
Right.
It's not some of these other songs that right. we've been playing. But, you know, you got to keep on keeping on, right?
That's what they say. That's what they say. I'm trying that myself.
You know, it's funny. It's one of those things that, you know, the whole is better than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Chris Stein and Debbie Harry are a team. And without that together, this thing called Blondie, it doesn't quite work as well, does it?
No. And he, you know, he was involved in all of her solo
albums
too. But on this one, I think he wasn't well enough.
Oh, no.
To
he's deathly ill here.
Yeah. And he had some, you know, input on this album, but he wasn't in the recording studio with her and, you know, contributing that way. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure you can tell. Shortly after this, actually, she and Chris actually broke up.
Yeah.
Now, she doesn't say too much about that, except for that their dynamic had changed. So I suppose, you know, they were always really good at being partners and friends and collaborators in the musical world. And they didn't never stop doing that, actually.
Well,
they continued to do that. But, you know, whatever the romantic part that kept them together, we know that kind of waxes and wanes. And it was that part was over.
Well, it's just the fact that all the pieces of their relationship remained other than the
right.
sexual part.
Right.
So,
and that's,
you know,
I think that's
and,
really
and still
cool,
to this
actually.
Day, it seems like they are still as close as ever. And I think she says so in the book, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that he's just the most important person, basically,
in her life.
In her life. Yeah. And even though he's remarried and has kids, you know, or not remarried, he's married, you know, they still are very close. And in the same day that Chris and she broke up, Andy Warhol died, and that really affected her quite a bit because she was, first of all, you know, he painted her.
Yeah.
She was close to him. She was part of his circle. She was on his show, Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes, which was something that he did around that time. And, you know, it was like, it wasn't just shocking to her personally. It was changed the art world and the social life of New York City at the time too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he always supported her and Chris. So, you know, that was a really big deal for her. Luckily, not too long after that, John Waters asked her to be in the movie Hairspray in 1988.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that was apparently really, really fun for her to do. In fact, everybody that was on the set loved being in that movie, and they hated it when they finished production because, you know, it's like, as she said, we just wanted to live in that movie.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun working with John Waters and Divine, even though Divine died not too long after the movie was released.
He
had an enlarged heart.
That crazy Divine.
But I want to see that movie again because really fun
and
when it came out.
This was not the musical, this was the movie.
Yeah,
with I think Sonny Bono.
Sonny Bono was her husband.
And
Ricky Lake.
Ricky Lake, this is what makes Ricky Lake a star.
And Rick Ocasek was even in this movie. I don't remember what
just
he
recently
played.
Passed right. Debbie Harry was Velma Von Tussle. And of course, you know, just a crazy, fantastic, wonderful, weird John Waters movie. So,
and it had a really good, it tackled racism too, in you know, Baltimore, and it had a really good
that's
social message while still being fun and everything.
One. And then she continues to make several solo albums over the next few decades. None that, you know, are in the class of Blondie. Does she say anything about that? About, you know, the difficulty of it? Or, you know, she had moved on to maybe not looking for pop stardom, but just, you know, a creative outlet or any of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that happens to most of the people I read about. You know, they become really big, you know, in this band that they're in. And then, you know, they have other things they want to do. And they're not as interested in kind of being wildly famous anymore because they've been wildly famous. So, you know, they have some room to do the other things that they wanted to do. So it doesn't sound like she was particularly, you know, disappointed by how her albums were received by record labels and the company, whether they went number one. I mean, I'm sure she was, but she doesn't, you know, really press on that. So
well,
she
still
had
an embedded fan base is there. Right. So, you know, you have some carte blanche to experiment a bit. And still retain, a record buying public.
Right. And, you know, one of the projects she worked on in this time period was she started touring with a avant-garde New York jazz band named the Jazz Passengers. And she really liked that because she wasn't the front of the band. You know, she was just the singer in the band. So it wasn't her band. And so she had the freedom just to be a singer. And also jazz is not an easy genre to learn, as what she said was, all those years in a rock band, I have been counting to four, and now I was expected to count to six or seven.
Okay.
Which really perfectly, I remember listening to a live jazz band and going like, where's the one beat in all of this? Like my friend was saying, you have to listen to the bass. The bass has the tonic. That's the one.
Right.
Okay. You know, it's a training experience.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And she had to learn a whole bunch of new songs.
Expanding her horizons.
Yeah.
All right. Well, she did four solo albums from, I think, 82 to, I think, 93, 94 was her last one. And then, like, Blondie kind of gets back together.
Yeah.
That was
Chris's idea. Chris called and said, let's get Blondie back together. And she said, you must be mad. The drugs, the illness, the financial ruin. You know, like what was good about that? She had felt lucky they got out of it alive because so many of their other friends were already gone.
Right.
But Chris talked her into it. And when they got the band back together, of course, this is like the story of Snow White and the, well, I'm going really astray here, but you know, the godmothers that were brought to her christening, and there was one left out and she became the evil
stepmother.
Yeah.
Or the evil queen, right.
Witch or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So basically they gathered everybody.
We're mixing our brother Grimm around here, but yes, I get you.
They, mm-hmm. they gathered Clem Burke, Jimmy Destri, and Gary Valentine back together, but they did not invite or welcome Nigel Harrison and Frank Infante into the reunion. And those former members unsuccessfully sued to prevent the reunion under the name Blondie, but they did not win the suit.
It's funny. Bands and their political dynamics have changed quite a bit over the decades. Where, you know, in the past there was, you know, this expected lifetime. It was a beginning, a middle, and an end. And once you hit that end, it's over, which is silly because you have a lifetime that you may decide to get back together with some of these people from time to time and, you know, have the artistic, when the inspiration strikes, you have this artistic pursuit that is available. But, I can understand maybe not playing with certain people, but, you know, if you look at the credits, you look at the background, I think most people walk away and say, hey, look, Blondie is really Debbie Harry and Chris Stein first and foremost.
Right.
And, you know, I would definitely throw Clem Burke in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, his drumming just was able to create some of those, you know, we've talked about these disco beats that kept coming up into their music, but it isn't exactly disco. It's disco with some power. And I think that's what Clem is bringing to the party here.
Yeah. Well, plus he's the only one besides Chris and Debbie who were in the band during all of its iterations.
You know, with that keyboard, well, especially the early stuff, you know, that Farfisa and things like that.
Yeah.
So he kind of
synthesizers
comes in.
But were important.
Look, you're not going to have Blondie without Debbie Harry. Other than that, you kind of can have Blondie.
Yeah.
You know, I think in the public's mind.
Right.
So
let's listen to a song.
Yeah, because they came back in 1999 with a new album, right?
Yeah, and it's called No Exit.
Yeah,
and this song is great, Maria.
Maria, yeah, it's a great song, a great return. So, all right, let's hear Maria.
She don't care. Smooth as silk, cool as air. Ooh, doesn't know your name, and your heart beats like a subway train. You wanna take her?
Okay.
That was a great comeback.
Yeah.
And a Jimmy Destri song, by the way.
I like that one a lot.
So again, it's important, Jimmy. Is he still in the band?
No.
I don't think so. Yeah.
No.
Oh, well.
He left in 2004. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, speaking of that.
Speaking of 2004.
Well, speaking of getting towards 2006,
right.
They were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And she was surprised. She thought that many other groups would have gotten in before them. And then she also knew that Blondie was not taken that seriously by the music industry. But then again, she had never taken the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that seriously either. But it felt good to get validation. So they all went, and even some of the former band members were invited and got their statuettes. But I think unbeknownst to her and Chris and the people that were in the current band, they didn't know that Frank and Nigel and Gary Valentine. Okay, so Frank is Frank Infante, Nigel Harrison, and Gary Valentine had gotten on the stage behind them and decided to say a few words as well.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Didn't go well.
Yes. And so Frankie grabbed the microphone as Debbie and Chris left.
To go prepare to play.
To go to the stage so that they could play their song.
Uh-huh.
Frankie and Nigel and Gary Valentine kept talking. And Frankie grabbed the microphone and thanked the Hall of Fame for not writing him and the others out of rock and roll history. And then he said, one thing that could make it better is if we could perform for you tonight. But for some reason, some of us are not allowed to do that. And then he called out to Debbie to, please, can you please let us play? It was very, like, embarrassing,
I thought. Yeah. And she just, like a boss, gets up to the microphone and says, no.
No, you can't.
This is my band over there.
Yeah. And we're going to play. And these are the guys in the band. And she starts saying who's on the stage.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. This is a subject that our friends at Who Cares About the Rock Hall, Joe Quazala and Kristen Studdard, should consider as topic of their show, of like crazy nastiness for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something like that.
Yeah.
Huh?
Sounds like a good topic. Like embarrassing things that happened at Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony. Yep.
All right. They make it in 2006.
Yep.
Rightfully so.
Right.
And
they go on to do a couple other albums.
A
couple other albums. The last one was in 2017. It's called Pollinator.
That's right.
They made that in the same studio that called the Magic Shop that David Bowie had recorded Black Star. And in fact, David passed away while they were on a holiday recess from making that album. And they were the last band really to make an album
before they closed it. Yeah.
So they felt really like that, you know, she felt like David was a big part of their career and he really supported them. And it was really special to be in the studio where he had made his last album.
I thought
that was a touching story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, get to the end of the book. I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
And it was really fun with all of the art in it, you know, to look at these great, you know, interesting pictures of Debbie that her fans had painted and drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And she really felt, you know, when she looks back, she feels like she really broke ground as a female artist in a business that was a man's world. And she just got on with it. And as much as possible, she found out how to do the things she wanted to do. She also says she's happier now than she was when she was young because she knows who she is, even if she's, you know, not doing exactly what she wants to do. She's comfortable with who she is. But those early days in New York were the best thing in the world that could have happened to her. And like a lot of the artists that we read about, you know, she was in the right place at the right time for the kind of personality she had and the kind of talents she had. And she really, you know, made use of that and, you know, dived in.
I think she's a very self-aware artist.
Yeah.
She knew her place and time and then crafted a persona to fit that mold that was needed.
Yeah.
And that made her into, you know, an international superstar for decades and still to this day is thought of as, you know, a very female empowered iconic figure.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, she's someone like, you know, Chrissy Hynde, I really admire. Mm-hmm. Cyndi Lauper, you know, take your life and take your musical, you know, world into your hands and shake it up and insist on doing it your way.
Well, glad you liked it. I hope everybody gets a chance to go out there and read it.
Yes, there's a lot of really, really more great stories in that book.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, that's it for this edition of the Rock and Roll Librarian. Do we know what we're doing next?
I'm still kind of wrestling with two books that I want to read, and I'm trying to decide what order to do them in.
Oh, and what are those two books?
Oh, Booker T. Jones' memoir, Time is Tight, and a biography on Benjamin Orr of the Cars,
because
I think after
timely.
Rick Ocasek died, you know,
people
are interested in the story of the Cars.
Well, maybe our fans will send us some feedback and help make that decision.
That would be really cool.
All right.
You can write to me on Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle again?
Sorensen Shelley.
There you go. Okay, let's get out of here and leave everybody with one last Blondie song.
Yeah.
Hanging on the Telephone. Bye, Gracie.
Bye-bye.
I'm in the phone booth. It's the one across the hall.
The Rock and Roll Librarian, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. Co-host, Shelley Sorensen. All sound design and incidental music by Jerry Danielson. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at the RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hi, I'm Cindy Howes. Basic Folk is my podcast featuring honest conversations with folk musicians.
A crisis is actually kind of exhilarating. You know what to do. I unplugged from the internet. I walked every day, even if it was 5 below. One day I walked.
Hope you had a good pair of gloves.
I did.
Great.
Thank you.
Can you talk about Bob Dylan?
I can.
How you met him and your favorite memory of him?
Well, you're not going to get that one.
This podcast fosters the folk music community and showcases a genre that is often misunderstood. Ironically, Basic Folk features complex conversations about the human experience witnessed from an artistic angle.
Whatever I was telling myself in terms of like, oh, it's like important for me to like just keep my personal life and my career separate. No matter how you kind of justify it, there's something that's not good for you. The psychological buildup over time, even of just like having to check myself in conversation. That's just like not healthy.
How do you approach both of these like very straight worlds as a musician and as a human being who doesn't fit those stereotypes?
I'm on a rainbow colored unicorn flying at them, and they don't know what to do with me, but I'm there like a little bee.
Our definition of folk is extremely broad, so you'll hear interviews from Katie Tunstall, Livingston Taylor, Amanda Shires, and many more on Basic Folk, available wherever you get your podcasts or at cindyhouse.net. Basic Folk is part of the Pantheon Podcast Group. Thanks for listening. Okay, bye.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.